Happy holidays from WCCO. It's 12:09 on a snowy Saturday. Eric Nelson in for Steve Thompson. Glad you've tuned us in. Minnesota Law returns again, the final episode of 2009. And Tom Schroyer, we're going to take a look back this week. Plenty to dig into.
Absolutely. We're here today, Eric, with Brian Grogan. And Brian is a co-host with me on Minnesota Law, has appeared throughout this 2009 season with us here. And Brian and I will be talking about big events in the law in Minnesota during 2009. We have several items picked out. We'd be happy as well to hear from any listener who wants to share questions or comments about their observations and thoughts about 2009 in terms of, you know, legal developments, court activities, and the like. And Brian, of course, joins us as well as a director of Moss and Barnett and an individual with a national legal practice representing municipalities and governments throughout the United States on various matters relating to infrastructure, including their Wi-Fi and cable television and the like. And so, Brian, welcome to you. Happy New Year and holidays.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're going to be starting out talking about something that's very appropriate, even though the Vikings aren't on until Monday, and that is the status of the Williams Wall in 2009. That really was quite a case in Minnesota involving Vikings defensive linemen Pat and Kevin Williams.
Right. It was, and the interesting thing about this case is it started, of course, about StarCaps, you know, a drug that was supposedly taken to help them lose weight. But the legal case itself ended up on really turning on a whole number of different issues. Maybe I can start describing this by just giving everybody a brief overview of what happened here.
Well, I think that would be important, especially, Eric, for our fans in Wisconsin and from Green Bay who think this was just a hometown deal.
Yeah, they think there was a little home cooking here at the state level. I'm sure Brian will be able to break that down and dispel that myth. But, you know, early on, the NFL wanted to suspend Pat and Kevin Williams for the StarCaps incident, and of course some other players involved, ironically a couple of them in New Orleans with the Saints. So go back to square one if you could, Brian, and tell us how we got to where we are now, where these guys have not missed a game yet.
Sure, and it happened really about two, 3 years ago. Back in December of 2006, the NFL came out with a proclamation about dietary supplemental prohibitions, and they said what you could and you couldn't take. It's interesting that a lot of folks have actually tested positive for this prior to 2006, never were suspended, no disciplinary action taken by the NFL. But then they started to prohibit this substance, and a lot has been written about the fact that, you know, players are responsible for what they put into their own body, and they're supposed to know better if some of these substances are on the prohibited list. The players were actually found tested in August of 2008, and they were suspended in October of 2008. And the argument was, you know, again, they took this thing called StarCaps, which contains a drug called bumetanide, and that is supposed to help them lose weight. Players take that because some players, you know, they're large guys, and they're supposed to keep their weight down. It's part of their contract, their standard player contract. Some would argue that's a masking agent for other things. That's really not relevant to the case. But it went through, and they were suspended for four games. They appealed it, went to an arbitrator, and ultimately, they ended up filing a lawsuit in state court, and that happened in December of 2008. Now, while all this is pending, the guys continue to play. They were not suspended, and we went through the 2008 season. The NFL decided that they wanted to move this to a federal court, so they removed it from state to federal court. And as Tom knows, this is where you get into some litigation maneuvering between home cooking and federal court. You want to try to be in state court if you can. Judges here are familiar with the Vikings. They're familiar with the case. It's better to be in front of a state court judge.
Well, absolutely, Brian. And so normally we'd think of this as a situation where a pro sports league, whether it's baseball or basketball, hockey or football, can have its own rules and have its way with what those are going to be. And it dish out fines for being too rough or being unsportsmanlike. Why hasn't that the case with this situation?
What they found out is we have really two different contracts here. We have the labor contract that we have between the NFL Players Association and the NFL itself. So that's a collective bargaining agreement. But then we also have a standard player contract, which Pat and Kevin Williams each have with the Vikings. So as this case moved to federal court and ultimately up to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, the question became, who actually employs the Williams wall?
So you mean this case doesn't turn on whether or not they took this StarCap drug with the bad ingredients, but rather on issues of law?
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, often the way it plays is this started out as a case of trying to lose weight with a drug. It ends up being really an employment law case.
Okay.
And the reason that's important is, do these federal laws apply or do the state laws apply? So right now the posture of the case is we've gone all the way up to the Eighth Circuit, and virtually the NFL has won on every issue they brought up. All the defenses that the players brought forward, they've all been dismissed. And so now we're back at state court in front of Judge Larson on the simple issue of whether Minnesota state law, and it's a law called the Minnesota Drug and Alcohol Testing in the Workplace Act, would apply because the standard player contract that each of the players have entered into with the Vikings is governed by Minnesota state law, not federal law. So, you know, at the Eighth Circuit, though, the real question that was interesting is they heard this with three judges at the Eighth Circuit, and that's typical for an appeal. It goes in front of three judges. There's several more judges at the Eighth Circuit, and the NFL wasn't pleased with that decision. So they asked for something called a hearing en banc, which means they wanted the entire Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals to hear this. Usually that's a matter of rubber stamping this decision. But in this case, four of the justices actually dissented from the decision and said, we think the three-judge panel got it wrong, basically agreeing with the NFL. So the real question becomes, is a collective bargaining agreement enforceable here, or is the standard player contract enforceable? And that's where this case will ultimately be decided.
And when you boil it all down, what a lot of Viking fans want to know, a playoff-bound football team, is there a chance, looking forward, these two could still be suspended and maybe miss postseason games or games next year?
Well, all of the state court issues were stayed pending the outcome of the federal appeals court process. So when we went to the Eighth Circuit this fall, and that happened in basically between August and December this fall, the Judge Larson had stayed the proceedings, which means he basically suspended everything, waiting to see what the Eighth Circuit was going to do. Now that decision's done, and everything has been kicked back to state court. So now the question is, how soon will Judge Larson hear this? As a matter of practice, there's nothing that would compel him to hear this before the end of the season, before the Super Bowl, if God's on our side there and we actually get before the Super Bowl. But logic dictates that this is probably going to occur after that. It'd be somewhat unprecedented if he were to accelerate the hearing schedule, and nothing would compel him to do that. That's, again, an advantage as to why we want to be in Minnesota State Court, because, again, a little bit of home cooking never hurts the home team.
Exactly right. My understanding, Brian, is that Judge Gary Larson in Hennepin County has set this on for a pretrial in mid-February with a trial to be following that. So, Eric, we should be good to go all the way through the big one.
Now the onus is on the Vikings to deliver. No excuses, right?
Exactly right. And so, you know, some interesting questions come out of this. For example, if Pat Williams does retire at the end of this year, you know, he's not going to have to serve out any of his four-game suspension. A question as to whether or not he'll have to pay any fines as a result of this, even though he's not going to have to sit out games, if that's the case.
Right. I mean, you know, each of these players was initially subject to a four-game suspension without pay, which is, you know, largely you're talking about, what, a fourth of their player's salary for a given year. I've read in the paper recently where Pat Williams said he'd like nothing more than to go out with a Super Bowl win. He's, what, 37-year-old defensive tackle? That's getting up there for a defensive tackle, even though he's still a Pro Bowl-caliber player. But if he were to retire and then ultimately lose on this state court issue, what sanctions could the NFL impose? Could they go back retroactively? You know, I suspect that's an issue that will ultimately play out in the collective bargaining agreement.
Interesting stuff as we move forward. We'll continue with more Minnesota law. Brian Grogan, Tom Schroyer from Moss and Barnett, Jim Engblom in the house, and of course the Big M, Chris Elston, running the board. Going to keep us out of the ditch on a snowy Saturday here on News Radio 830 WCCO. Light snow in the Twin Cities on a Saturday, the day after Christmas, 12:23. Minnesota law. Eric Nelson in for Steve Thompson this week. Tom Schroyer here, Brian Grogan from Moss and Barnett. If you want to give the program a call, please do so. 651-989-9226 in the Metro, or 866-989-9226. That's the toll-free line. or send us a text, 81807, 81807, powered by Wellington Window and Door Company. And this next topic, Brian, may stir up some of our listeners out there. You guys were briefing me on this, a DUI-related issue where you loan your car or tell somebody they can use your car. Maybe it's your spouse, your son, even your roommate. They go out and get a DUI. You can be on the hook.
Right. I mean, it's a timely topic because we're in the holiday season. Yeah. Everybody's out celebrating. Heaven forbid things can get out of hand and people can maybe have one too many. But a recent case was decided talking about vehicle forfeiture. And it's pretty amazing in terms of what may be at stake. Tom, give us an overview of what this case decided.
Well, sure, Brian. It was decided here just a few weeks ago, but it is really one of the bigger cases that's decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2009. It's generated a lot of interest. And what it involved is Minnesota's vehicle forfeiture law, which applies when a party has been convicted of driving under the influence and also applies not only to vehicles, motor vehicles, but also to boats when there's been a finding of boating while under the influence and or driving as a result of a suspension or failing to take a breathalyzer. Those can all trigger this law. But really the case arose when a married couple were golfing one day, and the at the end of the day, the one of the spouses, the wife, it happened, ended up sticking around at the golf course, the country club, and having dinner and who knows what, I suppose a few cocktails or whatever with her friends. Ends up later that night, the husband gets a call and from the wife saying that she'd been arrested for DUI. And so that was that. But the next thing that happened is the couple had a Chevrolet Tahoe, a brand new Chevrolet Tahoe, so not an inconsequential vehicle. It was titled only in the husband's name, but guess what? The county attorney, with the cooperation of the judiciary, seized the vehicle and held it under Minnesota's forfeiture law because the it had been involved in the act of driving under the influence. And so it's a very interesting decision because basically what it came down to is the court held that the spouse who was not on the title of the vehicle was actually an owner of the car, and thus it was subject to automatic forfeiture.
Now, the ramifications of this, Tom, seem to run almost limitless. As we were talking in preparation for the show, if I have a teenage daughter then, and let's assume that that the little Saturn that I have them drive that's worth about $2,500 is in the shop, so I let them drive my car, which isn't worth a heck of a lot more, but a little bit more. They get in a bad situation, get a DWI. I can lose my car because they're in my household, or how does it apply? Does it apply to everybody in the house?
Well, it does apply quite broadly, but the answer is that it's not automatic if it's someone who's just in your household that the car would be subject to forfeiture. It's rather if they are an owner of the vehicle with you. And the Supreme Court focused on the fact that in the case we're talking about with the Tahoe, the car was titled in the name of the husband only, but the wife had her own set of keys to the car and was able to drive it at her will without asking for his permission to do so. But in your situation, returning to that for a moment, yes, teenagers and other relatives in the household, including grandparents, siblings of yours, if any, nieces, uncles, they are all members of the household. And if you loan your car keys to them and they're driving and subject to DUI conviction, you could lose your license or your vehicle unless you can show that you took reasonable steps to safeguard against the possibility that they would drive it while under the influence of alcohol.
So reasonable steps. What's maybe the punch list of issues that you should be thinking about then with respect to your brother that you live with or your wife or your children? What are the reasonable steps one has to take?
Well, first of all, if this person has been convicted of a DUI three times, that's almost an automatic guarantee that you can't give them the keys to your car. Otherwise, it would be making sure you talk through these issues with them before you give them a car. In the case of young people, maybe enforce the curfew, maybe make sure that they're at a party where there's no alcohol going to be made available, that sort of thing.
And this can apply to boating as well. So as we come up on spring and summer in 2010, you're out on the St. Croix River, you've got to be cautious about that as well, because boats, by their very nature, are driven by several people over the day.
Yeah, absolutely right. So this is something people are going to really have to take into consideration, boats, vehicles, whatever. Be careful who you're going to let drive your boat or your car or your truck. More Minnesota law coming up on News Radio 830 WCCO. Plenty of topics to chew on today. The final 2009 edition of Minnesota Law with Tom Schroyer and Brian Grogan. I'm Eric Nelson. Phone lines are open. A couple of lines are. If you want to give us a ring at 651-989-9226 or 866-989-9226. Gentleman John in White Bear Lake has a question. Hi, John.
I was wondering if you could address the issue of that the counties and the judges are very, very hungry in this confiscation issue.
Oh, sure, John. Thanks for calling. It's I suppose on the one hand, possible to say that certainly all governments are looking for more sources of revenue. But I don't have the impression that this is a fundraising issue. And I would say furthermore that the law is applied with discretion, so it isn't as though it's an automatic necessarily each and every time. And there's wiggle room in terms of if the driver is not the owner of the vehicle, for the actual owner to demonstrate that they used reasonable care in making sure that whomever they were lending their vehicle was not driving under the influence.
Tom, you know, the question is, or was raised in the break, is this actually constitutional to have the government seize a vehicle, even though I wasn't the one, it's my vehicle, I wasn't driving it, wasn't driving under the influence, and yet I don't have a car anymore. Is that constitutional?
Well, I would say to that very same point, Brian, that this was an unusual case in that our Minnesota Supreme Court split on the decision in a 4-3 decision, with Justices Alan Page and Helen Meyer joining Justice Paul Anderson, who wrote what I would call a very strong dissent against this, on the grounds that, in fact, the power to seize property is something that is extraordinarily powerful and thus should be narrowly, very narrowly and rigidly enforced and limited, so that the government can't abuse the statute that we're talking about. I would say, on the other hand, that Justice Laurie Gilday issued a very well-reasoned, quite thorough analysis of why this was an appropriate exercise of legislative power by our state representatives. And further to the point, two of the justices who joined with her in the majority opinion, Justice Barry Anderson and Justice Chris Dietzen, both concurred on the grounds that they had taken a look at the constitutionality and concluded that it did pass constitutional muster.
You know, Tom, it occurs to me that when you talk about a brand new Tahoe, which was the car in this situation, a lot of people can't pay for that with cash. So let's assume that's a $40,000 car. And if I have a roommate that goes out, he borrows my car, gets a DWI, that car gets seized, I'm still stuck not only paying the $40,000 note I had on the car, but now I don't have a car to use. That's the way that plays out, huh?
The answer is that it could end up that as the owner you might end up paying on the loan, even though the car is sold at a sheriff's sale. But that's true only if the proceeds of the sale are insufficient to pay off the loan. If the loan is less than what they realized from the sale of the car at auction, then the loan gets paid off and the balance goes to the government rather than the whole amount.
Interesting stuff, and it would make one wary, I would think, at the very least, about who you're going to let drive your vehicle moving forward. We've got some other major topics we want to get into regarding what happened in 2009. Certainly, a lot of us learned what the phrase Ponzi scheme meant. We heard the names, you know, Madoff, Petters, Hecker, a lot of stuff swirling around those guys. Is it an unprecedented year in that regard in terms of what we saw?
Well, I'm going to turn to Tom Schroyer because he handles a lot of this complex financial litigation, represents an awful lot of different business entities in litigation involving these issues. But maybe we could start with just an overview. What the heck does Ponzi mean? I think it's some kind of a pyramid issue. first one in gets their money, but eventually somebody's left holding the bucket with nothing left. Maybe give us a brief overview and then how it played out in 2009.
Oh, absolutely, Brian. And, of course, Ponzi schemes are named after Mr. Ponzi, an Italian who preyed on immigrants around the turn of the 1900s. And he basically operated something as simple as most Ponzi schemes are. He raised money by asking people to give him their money and with the promise that he'd repay it shortly with a very high rate of return and without any risk. And, of course, there was no business underlying the operation, so he had no chance to earn an honest profit with which to repay the loan plus the interest. And so he would just go out and ask more people for new money to pay back the prior investors. And so that's kind of the definition classically of a Ponzi scheme. It's been embellished over the years, and we've seen some very sophisticated variations on that with both Tom Petters and with Bernie Madoff and a number of others. I mean, my goodness, there have been approaching 100 Ponzi schemes that came out of the woodwork here with the hard fall and crash of our economy since the fall of 2008.
You know, when you talk about a Ponzi scheme that involves individuals giving, you know, $1,000, $10,000, you can see how they might get duped into it. But in the case of Madoff and Petters, these were sophisticated institutional investors that had, you know, fleets of professionals that typically do due diligence and check out their investments, and yet these individuals and their firms were able to dupe them. How does it occur that you can invest, you know, tens of millions of dollars and not do more investigation and know what you're getting?
Well, exactly right. In fact, I'm aware of several investors in, for example, the Petters situation, where we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars being invested and with very sophisticated advisors. And so I think the answer lies in part in the unique circumstances of the past decade, and that is to say, first of all, we had a proliferation of hedge funds. And these Ponzi schemes tended to mimic hedge funds in that they were not transparent. And so the hedge funds were returning phenomenal returns to their investors around the idea that they weren't going to disclose exactly how they were making their money. And so it was created an environment, I think, where investors in Madoff and Petters were more susceptible to investing through what is always the case in these complex Ponzi's, and that is they have a black box, something no one sees into in order to find out what's going on. The other thing that happened here this decade, I believe, is that the tremendous stock market and real estate bubbles meant that they were able to satisfy their investors with rolling over their investments on the idea that they were still piling up more winnings and thus weren't asking for their initial investments back, because as soon as these people started to demand their payments back, these things unraveled overnight.
Now, some of these folks actually got their money out, right? The nature of a Ponzi scheme, like a pyramid, is if you were one of the first folks in, you might have gotten your return and you might have gotten your money out, but there's something that these folks have to worry about, too, something called a clawback litigation. And maybe describe for us what that means.
Sure. In all of these situations, the bankruptcy trustees or receivers who are safeguarding what's left of these Ponzi schemes are empowered by the law to go back after people who invested or put money in and get that money back from them if they either obtained it within 90 days of when the Ponzi scheme unraveled. In that case, it's called a preference item, or if they obtained more money out than they put in initially, then that is called a fraudulent conveyance, and that is also now become known as a clawback. And so literally, the receivers in bankruptcy can go back after early investors for, in some cases, up to 6 years to get back money that they took out. And if they're ahead of the game, they may have to pay back all of their winnings.
So let's give a practical example. If I invested with Madoff and 3 years ago, let's assume I was fortunate enough to have $1 million. 3 years ago, I got out $2 million because I got the benefit of that investment and whatever return was on it. I think I'm free and clear. I was one of the lucky ones that got out before the collapse. I may not be so lucky then. Somebody may be coming after that.
Well, it depends on how you define luck. You may have, been able to get back, and obviously under your scenario, you were able to get back all of your $1 million plus some kind of an investment premium, profit, if you will. Is it fair that you get to keep your initial principal, whereas somebody who came to the game later lost all of their initial investment and you took their part of that investment anyway, as your profit. So the courts have said, in fairness, if you took out more than you put in, let's put it back into the pot, and we'll mitigate some of the losses anyway of those who suffered.
And based on the harsh penalty Madoff got and one that we assume Petters will probably get, will the teeth in these sentences unravel future Ponzi schemes, or is this something going forward that's going to be in the news more and more?
Oh, I think that the answer is that we'll have an interval of time when people will be much more careful about this, and so we won't likely see them. But the next time we have a bubble, a long-running bubble like we have had here, I think we'll see just as many coming back because it's really quite an effective way to con people.
All right, very good. One more segment to go here on Minnesota Law with Tom Schroyer and Brian Grogan. It's 1245 here on News Radio 830 WCCO. Minnesota Law, 1249 on a snowy Saturday in the Twin Cities. Don't forget, next week we will air the best of Minnesota Law as we begin the new decade and the new year. Also a reminder, all shows are podcasted, so if you don't catch one or you get it in just segments and you want to hear the entire program, go to WCCORadio.com, WCCORadio.com, Minnesota Law. Brian Grogan, Tom Schroyer, Moss and Barnett, we've got one more segment to go. And as we look back on landmark events in 2009 from the legal standpoint, certainly Norm Coleman, Al Franken trying to figure out who won Minnesota's U.S. Senator seat there in Washington, D.C., that has to be right near the top.
Absolutely, Eric. We run the risk of getting into politics a little bit on this. And, of course, Brian and I both have strong political views. We come from different traditions, I think, by and large, or much of the time. So we are going to studiously avoid any partisanship on this discussion. But, Brian, I think it's fair to say, as Eric pointed out, that the re-election or the election recount for the U.S. senatorial position or seat was really a huge legal issue here.
Oh, it's without question. You know, as we were at break, it just occurred to me, we watched this healthcare debate in Washington, D.C., and it all comes down to one vote, one or another, whether you can have a filibuster or whether healthcare gets passed. And really what it comes down to is about 300 absentee ballots in Minnesota that decides the future of some of these questions at the federal level, because that's what this all hinged on in Franken and Coleman, was a handful of absentee ballots out of 3 million votes cast.
That's really incredible, Brian. And so let's go behind the headlines, because I know most people, and I'm included in that, you know, track the headlines religiously, of course. But, you know, it's hard to get down into the nuts and bolts. I know you've taken this decision apart. And as you say, it came down to 300 absentee ballots that is having such a huge impact here nationally right now.
Exactly. I mean, the brief recap is, you know, Coleman initially lost that election, right? He was down by a couple hundred votes.
I think it was the other way.
Oh, excuse me. My mistake. Franken initially came down about 250 votes. There was a mandatory recount because the margin was less than a half a percent. At that point, Franken took over the lead by a few hundred votes. Then we went to a state canvassing board to do the final recount. We went to a three-judge panel appointed by the Supreme Court. And then ultimately we went to the Supreme Court. And in the end, you know, we all know what happened. Obviously Franken won, but it was, again, by 300 votes. And it really all came down to absentee ballots. And the question was, when does a ballot count and when doesn't it? And the court had said there's about 10 key features of a legally valid absentee ballot. Everything from signing your name correctly to having it witnessed properly, your address, making sure the envelope matches the ballot itself, all of these things that a voter has to do by statute to make it a legally binding ballot. And the real interesting part of the case, I thought, was the court decided that a voter has to strictly comply with the statute in order for the vote to count. But once they do strictly comply, an election judge only has to comply to a basically substantial compliance level in order for it to be upheld over the course of the election. So by way of example, if you make a mistake in filling out your absentee ballot, you forget to have it witnessed, that ballot is then considered invalid. It no longer gets counted. But if you do everything right and the judge, you know, were to misplace the ballot, were to file it incorrectly, were to do any kind of shenanigans at the local precinct, even if it was different than election judges in other precincts around the state, the court said we're only going to require the judges to have substantial compliance. Coleman thought that was particularly unfair. Franken obviously thought that was just fine. But the lesson from this case was we hold that voter to a strict compliance, but once they have voted and they follow the statutory rights, we're not going to let that vote be invalidated because of the incompetence of an election judge sitting at a precinct, even if those rules are different. Up in Bemidji, down in Mankato, differences are okay, the court said, as long as the sanctity of that vote, once properly conducted, is then all the way, you know, carried all the way through, so there's no disenfranchisement.
Now, so with that same legal tenet, if you will, apply to the situation where we had a couple of instances, as I recall, in Minneapolis and Maplewood where some ballots were actually misplaced or destroyed?
Exactly. And the court in that situation, there was a precinct in Minneapolis where the vote count on election day was much higher than at the recount because several hundred votes were actually lost or misplaced. And in that case, the court said, look, if the votes were valid, the incompetence of the staff in that precinct to have properly stored and secured those ballots, we're not going to disenfranchise those voters that supposedly did everything they were supposed to do. We're not going to discount their votes. We're going to uphold them. So they actually, in that case, they didn't use the recount total. They used the total that occurred on the day of the election.
Did we, the state of Minnesota, get it right? I mean, is that the process that ultimately decides who really won? Because people still wonder.
I think the state got it right. Obviously, it took a lot of time. It was nearly a six-month process. We got it right as the laws were written at the time of that election. Now, whether those laws can be improved, whether the procedure can be improved upon, I think that's an issue that the legislature is going to take up in light of this decision and in light of the findings of fact issued by this three-judge panel to see if there are ways that we can make this process more transparent, make it more efficient and a little bit easier in the end to adjudicate. I know for one, I don't think that close elections are a thing of the past. I think we're a society that's going to largely have close elections for years to come. So we better have a procedure that works as efficiently as possible to make sure we get it right.
If for some reason the matter had been appealed by, assuming either side had been the loser, but if either side had appealed to the United States Supreme Court, we could still be waiting for an answer.
We could. And when we look at the major issues that are confronting Congress, I mean, we have very serious issues to deal with at the federal level. We need all of our senators in place. And certainly as a state of Minnesota, we need both senators out there. No matter who it was going to be, we needed two people at the discussion.
And so it also is striking to me, at least, that we have judicial officials, granted they're elected or subject to election, but still, we have judicial officials here again, as we have on other occasions in recent years, nationally and locally in other states, deciding elections.
Yeah, it's pretty unique when you look back at this decade. Obviously we had Bush-Gore litigation, and now we've had this in the state, and it's a sign of the times, I guess. We're a very evenly divided country, and like I say, I think these close elections may not be a thing of the past.
And also a very litigious country, as it turns out. We always want to talk a little bit about frivolous lawsuits here in our year-end retrospective, and I would say the top of the hat goes this year to Johnny Tsunami, who sued, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, more than anybody else in the history of humankind. And guess what? He sued the Guinness Book of World Records for publishing that. So,
wow. A man named Sue. Hey, guys, it's been a lot of fun. Happy New Year. And don't forget, next week, the best of Minnesota law right here on News Radio 830 WCCO.